I'm Judy Singer.
And I'm John Willis.
And we've travelled a long way to be here today, actually about three floors, I think, isn't that right, Judy?
Across the street from me.
And we've been interested for a long time in methods for analysing longitudinal data, because we believe that in the field of education and the social sciences in general, these methods have a very rich and powerful application. We've recently produced a new book on the topic of analysing longitudinal data analysis, and we'll be saying more about this later in our presentation. What we're going to try and do here for you on this video is kind of touch on some of the big issues that we think are the most important in this area of data analysis. And we're going to begin now with Judy commenting on the kind of state of data analytic affairs in education and social sciences.
We began by asking the question, how much longitudinal research is actually being conducted today? And in order to do that, we decided to take a very simple approach by using online databases that the Ovid company makes available. And we ended up searching in six different fields to see how often the keyword longitudinal was used over the last 20 years. What you can see is in the fields of medicine and psychology, for example, the amount of longitudinal research has been skyrocketing. In medicine, for example, there's been a 450% increase over the 20-year period from 82 to 2002. Psychology, a 365% increase. If you look at some other fields, like economics, a 361% increase, admittedly from a lower level initially, sociology up 245%. Agriculture and forestry, that top blue line, that is really skyrocketing. You see that rapid increase towards the end. There's been a lot more longitudinal research in those fields. One of the things that we find particularly problematic, however, is the last graph here. In education, which is the field that we actually come from, we see that over the 20-year period from 1982 to 2002, there's actually been an 8% decline in the amount of longitudinal research that's been published. Education has come under a lot of fire recently for not embracing randomized controlled trials as a way of doing research, and what we see here is that education also has some goals to strive towards with respect to longitudinal research as well. Now, that actually tells you about how much is out there. What it doesn't necessarily tell you is what these longitudinal studies look like. To get a feel for that, we ended up doing a very crude kind of survey, reading about 300 journal articles written in 1999 and 2003, about 150 articles each. And we chose psychology somewhat arbitrarily as a field where we thought there was an increase in the use of longitudinal research, and we would get a good sense for what's really out there. So we selected some journals, three issues of Developmental Psych, three issues of the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, two issues of the Journal of Applied Psychology, two issues of the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology. And what we found is that there actually are a lot of longitudinal studies out there. In 1999, a third of these papers were longitudinal. By 2003, nearly 50% were longitudinal. And as we started reading the articles, we thought, in fact, there was a lot of good stuff out there. In fact, a lot of these longitudinal studies are, in fact, truly longitudinal. In other words, they include three or more waves of data. You can see that in 99, it was 38% had four or more waves. By 2003, it was up to 45%. Three-wave studies were 26% and 29%. Two-wave studies are becoming less common. We see that as a very good trend. So to some extent, looking at the abstracts of these articles, we had a sense that things were really getting much better. Then we read the papers. And when you start reading the papers and you start seeing what people are actually doing in the field, you get a sense that we have a long, long way to go. In fact, if you looked at the analytic methods that were being used in these papers, in 1999, 91% of them were using what we call traditional methods of analysis, and I'll explain that in a second. By 2003, it had gone down to a mere 80%. But in essence, most people are using old-fashioned ways of analyzing the data. What do I mean by old-fashioned? Well, repeated measures analysis of variance is certainly the most common method, 40% of the articles in 99, 29% of the articles in 2003. There's nothing inherently wrong with repeated measures ANOVA, but the problem, when you look at the research questions these articles are asking, is they really are asking often about systematic patterns of change over time or event occurrence, and repeated measures ANOVA just really can't get at those kinds of questions. wave-to-wave regression, where you take a later wave and you regress it on an earlier wave. So you regress T3 on T2, T2 on T1, and then you find the same finding over and over again, and you think you've actually discovered something. Well, that's not a good way to handle these data, because the waves aren't independent of each other, and you actually want to be looking at the entire data set as a whole. Separate but parallel analyses, where you take slices through the data and you just analyze each wave, same exact problem. You think you're refinding something, but in fact you're looking at the same phenomenon over and over again. Other things that we found particularly appalling were people setting aside waves of data. Waves of data they had taken so much pain to collect, and they're setting aside 10% of these articles, which are setting aside these, or combining waves in some ways. Seems a really silly thing to do. And another 5 to 10% were ignoring age heterogeneity in the sample. So they were analyzing the data in terms of wave when there really was some other underlying metric for time, usually age, that would be more appropriate. In fact, when we dug deep and you look at how modern methods are just not being used, we see it as a crying shame. And in fact, the entire purpose of us writing the book and doing this video is to try to bring these modern methods of analysis to the field in terms of what actually happened in the growth modeling. In 99, 7% of the studies did. By 2003, it had doubled to 15%. Doubled is great, but it's still only at 15%. And survival analysis also doubled from a low of 2% to a high of 5%. Now, one of the questions is, why is it so bad? And we've been talking about this for years. John and I have been spending the last 15 years developing these methods, trying to promulgate them. And over the transom this summer, we got a sense of why the methods may not be used. We got reviews back on an article that was written by one of our doctoral students, Meredith Rowe, and she had done a very fine job analyzing three waves of longitudinal data on vocabulary growth in children. She had some very sophisticated growth models for the data, and it was a super paper. The reviewer's comments came back, and I'm going to do some dramatic readings here from this slide. Reviewer A: I do not understand the statistics used in this study deeply enough to evaluate their appropriateness. I imagine this is also true of 99% of the readers of developmental psychology. Previous studies in this area have used simple correlation and regression, which provide easily interpretable values for the relationships among variables. In all, while the authors are to be applauded for a detailed longitudinal studies, the analyses are difficult. I thus don't think this is really the place, developmental psychology, for this paper. The analysis is too hard. Use something easy. Doesn't make a difference if it answers the question. Second reviewer's comment: the analyses fail to live up to the promise of the clear and cogent introduction. I will note as a caveat that I entered the field before the advent of sophisticated growth modeling techniques, and they have always aroused my suspicion to some extent. I've tried to keep and to maintain an open mind, but parts of my review may be naive, if not inaccurate. They were. Now, I'm not saying this paper should have been accepted in whole cloth as it stood, but there seems to be an attitude in the field that I don't understand this. This came after I was trained. I may not understand what I'm talking about, but I'm going to feel good just saying don't publish it. And in the remainder of the talk, what we're going to try to do is convince you that, in fact, these methods are accessible. They have lots to offer you in terms of your research. And, in fact, it could open up new arenas of research that you may not have thought possible before.
Okay, so what kinds of research questions require longitudinal analytic methods? Well, really, there are two kinds of questions. There are questions that we call questions about systematic change over time, and there are questions about whether and when events occur. And what we'd like to do is give you a couple of examples of research studies in which these kinds of questions were asked. Our first example, then, is an example in which questions about systematic change over time were asked. This is a study conducted by Espy and colleagues in 2000 in which infant neurodevelopment was studied. These investigators took a look at 20 infants who'd been exposed to cocaine in the womb, and they had a control group of 20 infants who had not been exposed. Each of these children was observed daily for 2 weeks, and what was found was that the rates of neural development in these children who'd been exposed to cocaine was lower than the rate of development of children who'd not been exposed to cocaine. So the kinds of questions that have been asked in this study, there are really two kinds of questions. There's a question at the individual level, for instance, how does a particular infant's neurofunctioning change over time? And you might want to estimate, say, the rate of development for this particular child. But then there's a second kind of question, and it's a question about differences across children. And this was really the key research question in this study. And that question is whether the rates of development as a whole for one group of children, say the ones exposed to cocaine, are lower in general or on average than the children who've not been exposed. So these are questions about systematic inter-individual differences in change. And overall, these kinds of questions are answered by individual growth modeling. And to do that, you need what we call the multi-level model for change. And we'll talk about that shortly. The other kind of question that's asked often in longitudinal studies are questions about whether and when particular events, critical events in the human lifetime occur. And we have another example here from South 2001. This was a study of marriage duration. It was a large study. There were 3,523 couples involved. They were followed for 23 years until divorce occurred or until the study ended. And what these investigators found was that couples in which the wife was employed tended to divorce earlier. So the kinds of questions that were being asked in this study are questions like the following. Does each married couple eventually divorce? In other words, does each couple experience the critical event of interest, which in this case was divorce? And if they do experience this event, when are they at greatest risk in the duration of their marriage? When are they at the greatest risk of experiencing divorce? And then again, there's a question about what predicts these risks. How does the risk of divorce differ by different couple characteristics? And in this case, as we saw, the investigators found that it was the wife's employment that was appeared to be related to the risk of divorce. In order to answer questions like these, you need to conduct survival analysis. And there are two classes of survival analysis that we describe in our book, discrete time and continuous time survival analysis. We will introduce those shortly. So let me give you a quick overview then of what we mean by modeling change over time, this process of individual growth modeling. Well, as I pointed out when we were looking at the example in the previous slide, when investigators take a look at change over time, they really ask questions at two levels. They ask questions at an individual level. They ask questions about the individual child. And they also ask questions across children about whether differences in rates of development depend on other characteristics. Well, in order to analyze data and answer these kinds of questions, what one needs to do is postulate statistical models at each of two levels of this natural hierarchy. So at the what we call the level one, the individual child level, what we need to do is we need to postulate a statistical model which describes the change of the individual children over time. And then at level two, in order to answer questions about how change differs from child to child and what predicts that change, whether boys have a different kind of change than girls, for instance, we need a second statistical model. And we call this a model for inter-individual differences in change. And what it does is it hypothesizes a relationship between the individual change trajectories and these other background characteristics that we're interested in. Now, we'd like to give an example of each of these two kinds of models using some data that we have access to on gender differences in delinquent behavior among teens. And this is a large national sample. We have picked some specific cases from the sample to make our presentation today. What we'd like to do first is show you some data from one of the children. And this is a child with ID 994001. And by the way, all the data for our presentation are available on our website or through our website. And these same examples appear in our book. So what we're doing here at level one, at the individual level, is we're displaying the relationship between this particular child's delinquent behavior. And this is a self-reported measure of delinquent behavior. Children were asked, you know, how many times in a short period of time had they engaged in particular kinds of delinquent behavior like drinking, stealing, taking drugs, and so on. And so this is a composite measure of self-reported delinquent behavior. That's on the vertical axis. On the horizontal axis, we're recording the child's age, in this case from age 11 through 15. And so what I'm going to display is the data for this one child over time, because this measure was taken repeatedly. And what you see, we have three measures of data, three waves of data on this child, and what you notice is that over time, it looks as though this measure of the value of this measure of self-reported delinquent behavior rises, so that children, at least by their own self-reports, are engaging in higher levels of delinquent behavior as they get older during the teen years. Now, what we've done here on the plot is we've summarized this trend, this dotted line. What we did was we used ordinary least squares regression analysis, and we regressed delinquent behavior on age for this individual child, and we've plotted out the fitted trajectory for this child. So it's a kind of OLS summary of the trajectory of delinquent behavior over time, and it's kind of nice. I mean, what you get some sense of where the child's starting, you get some sense of the slope, the rate of development over time of this behavior. And now over on the right, what we've presented is the hypothesized model that would underpin this OLS regression analysis, and we're using a symbol Y to represent the outcome. Our key predictor is age, and you'll notice it's been centered on age 11, and the reason we've done that is so that the intercept of this trajectory occurs at age 11 rather than age 0. We're trying to keep the intercept within the range of the data. What's interesting about this model, there are a couple of things that are interesting. The first is, if you look at the subscripts on the outcome, you'll notice there are two subscripts, an I and a J. The I subscript recognizes the individual child, so each child will be distinguished by their value of the I subscript. The J subscript records the occasion, so in this case there are three occasions of measurement. J goes from 1, 2, and 3. What you'll notice is that both the outcome and the predictor have both an I and J subscript, indicating that these are repeated measures over time for this child. What's more interesting, though, is that the little regression model has two parameters. It has an intercept and a slope. We're using the symbol pi for these rather than the usual beta that you will have used in your kind of traditional data analyses. That's just a notation that's arisen in this literature. The pi zero is the initial status, the start, the intercept, for this child, and the pi 1, this is the rate of change in delinquent behavior over time. Now, what's interesting about these is that they also possess subscript I, and this captures the notion that each child has her own intercept and her own rate of change. And then finally, there's a residual. Now, the reason I'm stressing this subscript I on the parameters of the individual growth model is because it's these parameters that then are the outcomes in our second level analysis. And so now let's take a look at the second level analysis. What we've done here is we've now taken a small 12-person sample from the same large data set. We've conducted the same individual level analysis that we did for the first child, and we are displaying the OLS-fitted trajectories for all 12 children. And what you notice here is that each child has their own intercept estimate, and each child has their own slope estimate. So, and this is a consequence of the level one individual growth model having these individual specific parameters. Interestingly, we've coded the level two analysis using colors. The blue represent the boys, and the red represent the girls. And what you notice here, it's kind of interesting to look at these inter-individual differences in a kind of exploratory mode, and it looks as though there are some fairly clear distinctions between the boys and the girls, at least in terms of their elevation, if not in terms of their slopes. It's pretty clear, for instance, that in general the boys are all engaged in higher levels of delinquent behavior pretty much at all ages. But it's less clear that, on average, the rates of development of this delinquent behavior over time are really different between the two genders. Now, these kinds of inter-individual differences can be modeled again using a level 2 regression model. And the level 2 regression model is again interesting and may differ slightly from the kinds of regression models that you've seen in the past. At level 2, what we do is we represent the hypothesized relationship between each of the individual growth parameters that appeared at level 1, that's the intercept and the slope. We represent the relationship between each of these level 1 parameters and the predictors that are of interest to us as a consequence of our research question. So what we're interested in this particular analysis is whether the growth trajectories of these children differ by their gender. So at level 2, in order to capture these inter-individual differences in change and ask whether they're related to background characteristics, say gender in this particular case, what we do is we postulate a level 2 regression model. And it's interesting because, of course, there are a pair of outcomes. These are the level 1 intercept and slope. And what we are doing in this pair of regression models is asking whether the individual intercept and slope are related to our key question predictor, which in this case is male. The model contains a set of regression parameters. We're using the symbol gamma. And the key parameters of interest are really gamma 01 and gamma 11. And of course, if these are statistically significant, then we know that gender is related to the intercept and slope of the trajectory. In other words, that the change trajectories differ by gender. There are a couple of residuals. Now, we fitted this model to data using the HLM software. And what we found, interestingly enough, was that this parameter was statistically significant. In other words, the change trajectories for boys and girls really were at different elevations. But this parameter was not statistically significant and was close to zero. So in other words, the slopes were not statistically significantly different across the genders. And what we've done is we've displayed a pair of prototypical fitted lines here, prototypical fitted trajectories that represent the average trajectory for boys and the average trajectory for girls in the sample.
The second type of question about time is a question about event occurrence. And just like John just gave an overview of the statistical methods for the multi-level model for change, I'm now going to do a one-slide overview of the survival analysis model. The whole issue with survival analysis is a problem called censoring. And the problem called censoring is you're interested in studying whether or when events occur. But no matter how long data collection lasts, there are going to be some people who don't experience the events of interest during the period of data collection. So in the South study that John mentioned earlier in the talk, they were following people to see whether and when they eventually divorced. Fortunately, even over this 23-year period, many of the couples that they were following, in fact, stayed intact. The problem with censoring is trying to figure out what do you do with the data from those cases. For all the couples who divorced, you actually know when they divorced. Some divorced in the first year, the second year, up to year 23. But for all the couples who were still intact after 23 years, you don't know whether they'll divorce. And if they do divorce, you won't know when they divorce. So how do you analyze the data when your data set includes so many people for whom you don't know the outcome of interest? That's a problem called censoring. In other words, the end of data collection makes it difficult and possible for you to know when the event occurs for lots of people. And yet you simultaneously want to analyze the data for the people with known event times and the people with unknown event times, the censored event times. Lots of things have been tried in the literature. Setting aside the data from the censored cases, well, that's not a good idea because they actually tell you a lot about how to stay married. The people with the censored event times are the longest-lived marriages. If you set them aside from the analysis, you'll actually learn very little about why people actually stay together. Other ideas have been tried that include imputing event times, assigning them the event time at the end of data collection. Well, that's clearly silly because if you say that people have been married for 23 years have an event time of 23 years, you're actually making them all divorce, and you know that can't be possible. So the whole idea is to use what we call the survival analysis solution. Instead of just modeling the event times themselves, you build a statistical model of what's called the hazard function. And the hazard function provides a model of a way of looking at the temporal profile of risk over time. And the whole idea is that you can look over time and actually see whether and when the events occur, in this example, divorce, after the first year, after the second year, after the third year. But in each case, you're only looking at people who are at risk of the event. So all the people who have experienced the divorce in the first year come out of what's called the risk set. When you look at the data in the second year, you're only looking at those people who are still married. When you look at the data in the third year, only looking at people who are still married in year three, and so on. And so the whole idea is that hazard tells you about the conditional probability that the event will occur, given that it has not occurred at an earlier time. Now, strictly speaking, there are two different kinds of survival analysis. One is survival analysis that's conducted in discrete time. In discrete time, the event occurrence is measured usually at intervals, the year example that I just gave. So you know that things occurred in year one, year two, year three, but you don't know precisely when the events occurred during that time period. In the case of discrete time, as I just described that example, hazard is actually a probability, and as a probability, it's bounded between 0 and 1, and for ease of statistical analysis, we typically model its logit. The converse case is what's called continuous time survival analysis, and in continuous time survival analysis, you're collecting data in real time, and so you not only know the interval when an event occurred, you actually know the specific time when it occurred. So once again, in the marriage example, you would actually know the date people got married and the date people got divorced, and you would know the length of the marriage to the nearest day. When you're dealing with continuous time data, the outcome of event times can obviously take on many different values. Hazard is therefore a rate and not a probability, and therefore we model its logarithm. This is a subtle technical distinction, but it's something that if you get into these models, you really need to understand. Let's actually look at an example to give a sense of how this works. And this is a data set that was collected out on the West Coast with a cohort of young boys tracked from 6th grade to 12th grade. And among other things, researchers were interested in the grade of first heterosexual intercourse. So when did these young boys, starting in 6th grade, first have sex? And one of the predictors the researchers were interested in was the effect of what they called early parenting transitions. By early parenting transitions, we mean transitions in the family, so parents breaking up, getting back together, reconstituting, etc., at some point before the kids entered the study, so at some point before sixth grade. What we have here are two sample logit hazard functions for two groups of boys. The blue group of boys is the group who never experienced a parent transition, so their parents were intact up until the time they were in sixth grade. The pink group of boys is the group that did experience at least one parenting transition before they entered the study, before sixth grade. These two sample logit hazard functions give you a very good sense of the profile of risk over time. And there are two things that we're particularly interested in here. The first is the absolute level of risk. And you can see that at the beginning of the study, kids are at lower risk of having sex for the first time, and that gradually as they move through middle school and through high school, the risk of having sex for the first time steadily increases over time for both groups of boys. So, in fact, the risk is starting out low and rising over time. That's the general shape of the hazard function. Over and above that general shape of the hazard function, notice that there's a clear differential in risk. At every single grade, the hazard sample logit hazard function for boys who have experienced the parenting transition is consistently higher than the sample logit hazard function for boys who experienced no such transition. So notice what I've done in talking about the sample hazard plot. What I've done is I've partitioned the variation in risk, the variation in logit hazard, into two components. One that's telling me about the relative level over time, and the other that's telling me about the differential elevation in risk associated with the variation in the value of the predictor parenting transition. And what we see is that as the predictor parenting transition goes from the value 0 up to the value 1, there's a consistent shift in risk. When we build a statistical model of hazard, we in essence try to capture this kind of partition. And here what we have in the second panel are fitted logit hazard functions that are superimposed on the sample logit hazard functions from the first panel. Now, what you can see is that these fitted functions have a much more regular shape than did the sample functions. This is not unlike when you have a plot of data, regression data, for example, you have data points, and then you superimpose a fitted model on top of it. That's in essence what we've done here. But the difference is that instead of the data being actual data points like event times, the data that we're actually modeling are the sample logit hazard functions. To get a sense of what the actual statistical model is doing, let's look at its component parts. Notice on the left-hand side, we have the outcome, logit hazard. We use the symbol h, to little h, to denote hazard. We have t, because hazard is a function of time. And once again, we have two particular subscripts here. I for individuals, just like we have in growth modeling. J for time, just like we have in growth modeling. Notice on the right-hand side of the equation, we're partitioning the variation in logit hazard into two different components. The first we're calling alpha sub tj, and this is in essence what's called the baseline logit hazard function. In fact, in all methods of survival analysis, we have these baseline functions. They pretty much function like intercepts do in a regular regression model, but they're not regular intercepts. The reason they're not regular intercepts is that this baseline hazard function, logit hazard function, has the subscript j in it. So instead of being a single intercept as you would have in a regular regression model, it's in fact saying it's multiple intercepts, one per time period. So at the second part, notice we have something that looks very familiar from a regular regression equation. We have a parameter, beta 1, that's notified by a predictor, PT, representing parent transitions. Just like in a regular regression model or a regular logistic regression model, the behavior of beta 1 is to capture the shift in risk corresponding to unit differences in the value of the predictor. Here, because we're using a simple dummy variable, parenting transitions, which take on the values 0 and 1, beta 1 simply captures the shift in risk corresponding with differences between boys who have not experienced parenting transitions and boys who have. If beta 1 is positive, as it is here, what you have is that boys who experience the parenting transition are at greater risk of having sex in each grade than their counterparts who have not experienced the parenting transitions. And that's exactly what happens in this particular study.
So that was a kind of quick and dirty introduction to these two, what we're calling the modern methods of analyzing longitudinal data, individual growth modeling and survival analysis. And you can read more about it in the book. What we'd like to comment on now, what we see as four critical advantages to these methods over the traditional methods of data analysis with longitudinal data. The first advantage that we'd like to point out is that with these methods, you have much more flexibility in your research design. And in particular, one doesn't need to collect, one doesn't need to subject each person in the data collection to the same rigid data collection schedule. So one can collect data on different occasions, with different temporal spacings for different individuals. And in fact, each individual doesn't need to have the same number of waves of data. One can include in the same analysis folks that have 13 waves of data and even folks that have only one wave of data, it turns out. Of course, the people with only one wave of data, say in an individual growth modeling analysis, they don't tell you anything about the rate of development, but they do help you to pin down the intercept. The second advantage is that one is able to identify temporal patterns in the data. One can figure out whether the outcome is increasing and decreasing or remaining stable over time. And with multiple waves of data, one's also able to figure out whether the change is linear or nonlinear. One can even entertain interesting nonlinear trajectories for change, say, that may rise to an asymptote, this kind of thing. And so one enters a world of much richer research questions. Another thing that one can do, and we've gotten particularly interested in this, is the use of discontinuous trajectories and discontinuous risk functions, so that one is able to identify abrupt shifts in these risk functions or in these growth trajectories at particular important stages or periods of an individual's life. The third big advantage, and possibly this is the greatest of them all, is that one can include time-varying predictors in the analysis. We've stressed so far the fact that the outcome is time-varying, but one of the great flexibilities of these methods is that one can permit the predictors themselves to be the predictors to be time-varying as well. So things like an individual's participation in an intervention doesn't need to be fixed over time. It can change from occasion to occasion. Family composition may change. People may lose their jobs. People's levels of stress and self-esteem may fluctuate. And all of this can be incorporated into the analysis because time-varying predictors are permitted. And we actually think that many of the most important predictors in the social sciences are time-varying. The fourth advantage is that one can include interactions between your key question predictors and time. And what this permits one to do is to test whether the predictor's effect varies over time. And it's possible, for instance, that you may find an important impact of a particular predictor, such as, say, a parental transition in a child's life may have a huge impact on the risk of engaging in first heterosexual sex when the child is young, but the impact of that parental transmission may dissipate as the child gets older. So some effects dissipate, some effects may increase, and some effects may be just particularly pronounced at particular periods of an individual's life. And all of these can be entertained as interactions between time and the key question predictors. And what we'll do in the rest of the talk is give you some examples of each of these things.
Let's start out by talking about what it's like to include a time-varying predictor in the models. And what we're going to be doing is using a data set that's looking at the trajectories of depression symptomatology amongst people who were recently unemployed. Liz Janicki and her colleagues went to unemployment offices in Baltimore, Maryland, and tracked 254 people who were recently unemployed. They gave them the CESD scale, which is a standard scale of depression symptoms, at this first interview, which was conducted within 2 months of job loss, and then they tried to do it at two subsequent interviews, one that was conducted somewhere between 3 to 8 months of job loss, and another that was conducted between 10 to 16 months of job loss. You'll notice in this example that while we're including a time-varying predictor, and that's really what we're trying to illustrate here, the time-varying predictor is unemployment, because in fact, a lot of these people got reemployed during the period of data collection. There are several other things about this data set that are quite interesting. One is that the timing of the interviews varied across people. So while they were shooting for three waves for everybody, in fact, some people had one wave, some people had two waves, some had three waves, but the actual dates of data collection also differed. If you take a look at the data set, you can get a sense now for the first time in this talk about what longitudinal data actually looks like when it's in a computer. And here we have data for three individuals. You can see the months at which the interviews were conducted, and you can see that they're at three different points of time. You can see their CESD scales. So the first person was depressed pretty much all the way along. You can also see that that person was unemployed at all three waves. If you look at the second person, also quite depressed at first interview when he was unemployed, but in fact got a job by wave two, and the depression symptomatology went down quite a bit. The third case starts out at 27, pretty high when he's unemployed, goes down to 15 as he sort of gets used probably to being unemployed. By the third wave, he's reemployed again, and his CESD score is 7. Now, when you look at longitudinal data, and you're trying to specify a model, one of the best things you could do is not go fit the model. What you have to do is you have to draw sketches out of what you're hypothesizing happened in the population to give rise to the kind of sample data that we're seeing here. And in all the slides that follow, we're going to try to give these illustrated plots. Here we're going to start out with a very simple hypothesis, which is that the effect of this time-varying predictor, unemployment, remember, everybody starts out unemployed, but some people get reemployed, that the effect of this time-varying predictor is constant over time. What do I mean that it's constant over time? Well, take a look at these four graphs here. For someone who remains unemployed, we're hypothesizing probably that the level of depression symptomatology at the beginning is high and probably declines a little bit over time. We don't necessarily have to restrict that it's declining, but that's sort of what we think is happening. Then if we think about somebody who gets reemployed at 5 months, notice what happens. He starts out at that very same level, but at the point of reemployment, we see a drop in depression symptomatology, and then that sort of follows steadily over time. And we're indicating a parameter here, pi2i, that's one of those growth parameters that John talked about when he was introducing growth modeling. And that pi2i captures the magnitude in the shift, the decrease in the depression symptomatology for person I at getting reemployment. Here we have a similar example where the person is following along being unemployed, gets a job now at 10 months, And we're hypothesizing in this model that you have the same drop at 10 months if you get reemployed as you had at 5 months, pi to I. In the fourth graph here, we're looking at another group of people. It's a quite interesting group. They start out unemployed. They get reemployed at 5 months. They follow along. And then, unfortunately, they happen to get unemployed again. And what we're postulating in this model is that the increase in depression symptomatology associated with unemployment again is the same as the decrease was in the first place. So what does the statistical model look like? Well, the statistical model looks somewhat similar to what John introduced, but it has a little twist to it. At level one, once again, we have the outcome here at CESD scores, person I, time period J. We have the basic growth model that we had before for time, a linear growth model. And what we're doing is we're adding this time-varying predictor, unemployment, to the level one model with its own parameter, pi to I, that's allowing pi to I to capture these shifts in risk. At level two, we're going to start out quite simply saying that each of these level one growth parameters is some average value. We're not even putting in substantive predictors. So unlike the example that John gave earlier with gender predicting delinquent behavior, here we're just looking to see what happens on average. And a very interesting set of things happens. What I'm going to show you here are three different models we fit to these data. And in doing this, we're trying to give you a sense of how data analysis actually works in practice. What you don't do when you're analyzing your data is just take the data, come up with a statistical package, fit the models, and say you have the answer. You have to do real data analysis as you do in regression to try to see what's going on. And we fitted this model to data, and let me show you what we found. What we're going to show here are three different fitted models. Now remember, these are fitted models. That's different from the hypothesized pictures we saw at the previous page. And in fitting these three models, we were going through a sequence of analytic steps, looking at what we were finding in the statistical analyses, and then modifying the hypothesized model to go better with the sample data. Start out with the model we had in the previous slide. As we saw before, everybody starts on the unemployment line. And then if you get a job, it turns out that you drop by 5.11 points down to the unemployment equals zero line, the employed line. And then you continue down on that line. If you lose that job again and you become unemployed, you would rise back up to this line. The thing about this model is it's assuming the lines are parallel. But they don't have to be. Is it possible that the effect of unemployment, the effect of this time-varying predictor, might itself vary over time? Well, to answer that question, we fit yet a different model to the data. And this model is quite interesting. Look at the plot. What you see here is that the lines are no longer parallel. That's a feature of this model. And the feature of this model allows the effect of unemployment to itself vary over time. So the effect of unemployment is measured by the distance between these lines. Notice that the effect of unemployment is quite large when people are initially laid off. And then what it turns out in this sample is that the effect of unemployment declines over time. So the gap between those lines gets smaller. But look at the lines now. For the folks who are unemployed, we get pretty much what we'd expect. You know, you start out high and then you decline as you get used to being unemployed. For the folks who are reemployed, we get something that has the potential to be very strange. There's no data here at the beginning of time because everybody's unemployed. That's why we have it dashed. But once we have some data on people who are reemployed, notice that it appears that the CESD depression trajectory is actually rising. Does it make sense that it's really rising? Or is it possible that the slope of this second line is actually statistically indistinguishable from zero? So we fit yet a third model to these data. And as it turns out, this third model is the one that fits the best when you compare the goodness of fit of these three models. And in fact, it's a very interesting picture about what happens over time and how it's different for different groups of people. For the folks who are consistently unemployed, we get the same depression line that we've seen before. For the folks who get reemployed, the line for depression is in fact flat. So once you get a job, you drop down. The size of the drop is bigger if you get a job earlier and smaller if you get a job later, basically because you're getting more inured to the effects of unemployment here. But that once you come on to the reemployment line, in fact, there's no change in your depression status over time. So the effect of unemployment, a time-varying predictor, varies over time. At 3 months, at layoff, the effect is 6.88, and then it declines by a third of a point for each month. And this turns out to be the best fitting model for these data. The big point here is twofold. One, you can easily include time-varying predictors, and they're all over the place. In fact, once you're freed from looking at the effects of predictors like gender that are constant over time, you'll start seeing time-varying predictors all over the place. After all, you're collecting longitudinal data. One of the things you're trying to do is see how people change over time. The second is that you don't have to buy into what people often think of standard assumptions. You don't have to think that any predictor's effect is constant over time. In fact, if you think about your substantive theories, many of the predictors that you're especially interested are in fact predictors whose effect will themselves vary over time, whether those predictors are time varying, as in this case, or time invariant.
Okay, as a second example of the power of these methods, we'd like to take a look at some discontinuous growth trajectories. And this was a piece of work that was conducted by Dick Monet, Kathy Boudet, and myself. And we were interested in the careers of high school dropouts. After they dropped out from school, they entered the labor force. What did they earn? And were their earnings trajectories impacted by their acquisition of the GED, the General Education Diploma, which, as you know, is an alternative way of graduating from high school? We had 888 high school dropouts from the NLSY. The number and spacing of these waves of data differed enormously from dropout to dropout. Some only had one wave of data, some had as many as 14, stretching out many years. About 40% of the dropouts ultimately earned a GED, and the question that we had, our principal research question, was whether earning a GED affected the wage trajectory on entry into the labor force, and if so, how did it affect the trajectory? We thought we would start off by showing you a couple of examples of the data. So these are empirical growth plots for two of the dropouts. We're simply displaying here the raw data. So we have dropout one on the left, dropout two on the right. And on the vertical axis, we're displaying the hourly wage obtained by each of the dropouts, and on the horizontal axis, we're displaying the number of years in the labor force. For the first dropout, what you notice is that shortly after this adolescent dropped out of high school, entered the labor force, was earning about $5 and a quarter, around about minimum wage in those days. And as time passed, there were some slight increases in the earnings, but nothing dramatic. This dropout didn't get a GED at any time during his career in the labor force. The second dropout, on the other hand, we're displaying the same kind of data, the earnings against years in the labor force. But what we've illustrated to the right of the picture is we've indicated that this dropout obtained a GED shortly after the eighth year in the labor force, and then we've colored in the rest of the plot in the purple color. And what's interesting here is that appears to be a dramatic impact of the receipt of the GED. I've just been reminded by my partner over here, I should tell you these are inflation-adjusted wages. I apologize. So what we see, we don't quite know what happened on the second data point, by the way. Must have, had a kind of high-paying job for a year. But really what you see here is that the wage trajectory was struggling along up through about year 8, and then the GED was received, and for some reason, subsequent to the receipt of the GED, there was a kind of discontinuous disruption in the wage trajectory. And what we wanted to do in this particular analysis was model these trajectories and try to investigate the nature of these disruptions. We had several plausible alternative discontinuous models for the data, and this is rather similar to the previous slide that Judy described. So these are our hypotheses. We had a set of hypotheses. What we did was we fitted these to the data and determined which were the most appropriate. We had three alternative plausible hypotheses about how the acquisition of the GED might impact the wage trajectories of these dropouts, and let me try and illustrate for you these three plausible alternatives. Essentially, we decided that the GED may impact the elevation of the wage trajectory, it may impact the slope of the wage trajectory, or it may do both. And that's what these three pictures represent. So these are our hypotheses. These are not data. You'll notice that now we're displaying log wages against experience because it was log wages that we treated as the outcome in our analyses. But the first plot represents the impact of the GED on the elevation of the trajectory. The second plot represents the impact of the GED on the slope of the trajectory. And the third plot represents both of these effects taking place simultaneously. And so what happens is, say, in the first case, the dropout joins the labor force, his log wages rise with experience, he acquires the GED, and his wage trajectory experiences a little jig upwards. And then post-GED, the wage trajectory continues with the same slope. In the second case, we have a disruption in the slope of the trajectory, but no disruption in the elevation. And then in the third hypothesized plot, we have both of those things acting together. So the question is, how did we represent those hypotheses about the impact of the GED on the wage trajectory? How did we represent that in the individual growth modeling? And the way that we represented it was at level one, in our hypotheses for the individual growth trajectory itself. And so let me go along and show you what we did. In the case of the first hypothesis, what we did was we created a new variable, a time-varying predictor, which we called GED. And we gave this predictor the value zero on every occasion prior to the receipt of the GED. Once the dropout received the GED, we changed its value to 1. So on all occasions subsequent to the receipt of the GED, this variable, this time-varying predictor, took on value 1. By including that predictor in the level 1 model, we were able to capture this upwards jig in the elevation of the trajectory in this parameter here, pi 2. And then when we fit this model to data, we're able to estimate and ask whether it's significantly different from 0. The model also possesses a regular intercept, it possesses a regular slope, and so on. The second hypothesis, we needed a slightly different model. Here we created a new time-varying predictor, which we've called post-exp. And this is intended to represent the experience of the dropout in the labor force post-receipt of the GED. And the way that this variable is coded is it takes on a value 0 on all occasions prior to the receipt of the GED. Then subsequent to the receipt of the GED, it simply counts the time as it passes. So for instance, in this case, where the dropout has received the GED at year 3, post-exp has value 0 up to that point, and then post that point, it counts 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. So it captures change, it captures time, time measured from the receipt of the GED. And by including that in the level 1 model, we permit a change in the slope of the trajectory. And so this parameter here, pi 3, captures this change in the slope of the trajectory, this hypothesized change. And then finally, in the under the third condition, where we wanted to permit both a change in elevation and a change in slope, we simply included both time-varying predictors in the level 1 model, and we have both of these parameters, each of which captures the hypothesized effect, if in fact it's there. So while the level 1 individual growth models are a little complex, what they've enabled us to do is capture a series of very kind of interesting and powerful hypotheses about the impact of this key question predictor on the individual's change trajectories. We fitted these models to data using SAS-PROC mixed, and you can find a full account of this in our book, by the way. And what we found was that the GED had a considerable impact on the individual trajectories. I should mention at this point that at level 2, we included a variety of predictors that were the kinds of predictors that economists are typically interested in, things like particularly the ethnicity of the dropouts. And finally, we discovered that it was important to control for the highest grade that these dropouts had completed in high school, and you'll see the impact of that in a moment. So we fitted the model to data, and let me show you what we found. Here are a set of prototypical fitted trajectories obtained subsequent to our analyses. What we found was that dropouts who dropped out
earlier in their high school careers rather than later tended to be paid less on entry into the labor force. And you see this discrepancy right here, where the red trajectories are trajectories for individuals who dropped out in the ninth grade. The blue trajectories represent the wage trajectories for individuals who dropped out in 12th grade. And you'll notice that they paid considerably less, that the ninth grade dropouts paid considerably less on entry into the labor force. And that discrepancy remains constant over time. We also detected a disruption, a vertical jig in the wage trajectories on wage receipts. So what you notice here, and this is indicated here by the dotted line, this is the point at which this prototypical dropout earned his GED. And what you notice is that upon the receipt of GED, the wages rise immediately by 4.2%. And so you see, for instance, if we look at this lower trajectory for a ninth grade dropout, there's this immediate elevation of 4.2% on receipt of the GED. And the same feature you'll find, say, for the 12th grade dropouts, there's a 4.2% elevation. And then post-GED, there's also a change in the slope, so that post-GED receipt, the wages rise annually by 5.2%. And you'll notice here, if you compare the slope before and after, for, say, the ninth grade dropout, you'll notice the slope post-GED is slightly higher than prior to that. Finally, we discovered an effect of race. On dropout, there were, in fact, no differences there were no differences in wages due to race. And you see that here again. Let's look at the ninth grade dropout. What we're displaying here is a trajectory for a black dropout versus a trajectory for the white or Latino dropout. And you'll notice on dropout there are no difference in wages. But in fact, over time, the wages for blacks increase at a slower rate, and so you'll see that the trajectories diverge. And so by, say, 10 years into the labor force experience, there are considerable differences between blacks and whites and Latinos. And that's also reflected in the prototypical trajectories for the 12th grade dropouts. So this is really kind of an exciting piece of analysis. It's complex, but it captures a great deal of information in a single analysis, and was able to demonstrate effects that other researchers working with cross-sectional data had not been able to capture.
In all the examples we've showed you so far that illustrate the ability to include time-varying predictors and have the effects of predictors vary over time, we've been using growth modeling examples. In the next two examples, I'm going to use some survival analysis illustrations to illustrate similar sorts of ideas, but extend them in ways that we haven't shown in the other slides. I'm going to start out looking at the idea that you can code a time-varying predictor in different ways, and in doing so, you can be testing different substantive hypotheses about the effect of a simple time-varying predictor. And here what we're going to be looking at as an outcome is the risk of first depression onset. And the predictor, the time-varying predictor we're looking at, is the timing of a parental death. And the data that we're looking at is some data collected by Blair Wheaton up in Canada, did a probability sample of folks in Toronto, metropolitan Toronto, and was interested in stresses across the life course. And so they filled out a life course calendar, and he asked these 1,400 people whether and when each had experienced the first depression onset. Turns out that just over a quarter, 27.8, had experienced the first depression onset sometime between ages 4 and 39. And the research question here is there an effect of parental death on the risk of first depression onset? Notice in the question we have up here, we're distinguishing between two types of effects parental death might have. One is what we might call a long-term effect. In other words, once your parent dies, you carry that effect with you throughout your lifetime. The other kind of effect you might think parental death might have on the risk of depression onset is a short-term effect. When your parent dies, you are at very great risk of depression onset, but gradually over time, as you get used to the fact that your parent has died, the effect that your parent had died on your risk of depression onset dissipates. What we're going to show here is that it's possible to use sample data to evaluate these competing hypotheses, and what we're going to see in this particular example is that the evidence is quite striking that the effects are different. Here's the statistical model that we use to evaluate the data. There are a few things that we want to point out in looking at this. The first is, while we have the same outcome we've had before, logit hazard, notice that the baseline hazard function, which is the effect of time, is now being expressed as a very smooth function of age. We use these kinds of models even in discrete time survival analysis, because here these data were recorded to the nearest year, as a way of getting a smooth temporal profile over time. And we actually see it fit to data. You'll see how clear the patterns come out. We also have two substantive predictors here. One is beta 1 female. That's picking up the well-known gender differential. In study after study, it turns out that the risk of first depression onset is much higher among women in comparison to men. And the second is the effect of the parental death predictor. We've used the same word, PD, in both cases, but we're going to code it in two different ways. One's going to code it long-term, so its effect is going to persist over time. The other is going to code it short-term, so the effect only occurs in the immediate interval when the parent dies. Notice that parental death has two subscripts, I for individuals, J for time periods, whereas female only has one subscript, I for individuals. Here are the two fitted hazard functions when we fit this sample this hypothesized model to the sample data. Now, before going into the details, you'll see that the axes here are fitted hazard. They are on exactly the same scale, and even without looking at the detail, you can see that the hazard functions, the fitted hazard functions, very close together up here in the top panel, and they're in fact quite far apart in the bottom panel. And that's in fact what we're seeing here, is that the effect of parental death is really quite different depending upon how you code it. In the top panel, we're coding parental death as this long-term effect. And what happens is, if we take one of the genders, we take men, those are the two lower fitted hazard functions here, you start out at the lower level, and if your parent dies, you go up to the higher hazard function for your gender, and then you stay at that function. Whereas if your parents stay alive, you stay at the low hazard function for your gender. And when we look to see the magnitude of the effect, it turns out there is a statistically significant long-term effect of parental death. The odds of depression onset are in fact 33% higher amongst individuals who've experienced a parental death at some point in the past. What's interesting in contrast is how enormous the effect of parental death is if, instead of allowing it to be a long-term effect, we allow it to be just a short-term effect. Once again, we have four fitted hazard functions here. Now, the bottom two functions are for folks whose parents didn't die in a given year. The top two are for parents, folks whose parents did die in a given year. Let's start out again with men. So for a man, follows the bottom hazard function. In the year that his parent dies, his risk of depression onset goes to the top hazard function for his gender, and then goes back down, because we're coding this as a short-term effect. In fact, if you look across the sample, we estimate that the odds of first depression onset are 462% higher among individuals who experienced a parental death in that year in comparison to people who did not experience a parental death in that year. What we're hoping you see here is that time-varying predictors are interesting because you can be tracking people over time, and you can see how predictors' effects might You can see how predictors' values might change over time and how they might be related to changes in the outcome. But what really starts to get interesting at a very subtle level is the kinds of hypotheses you can develop related to your substantive research interests that allow you to code these time-varying predictors in ways that allow you to test very specific contrasting effects, such as the short-term effect here of parental death. You could imagine other kinds of very specific hypotheses where you allow the difference in coding of a predictor to really get at subtleties that are related to your theories. Now, here's the second example that we want to talk about in terms of the ability to use not just time-varying predictors, but predictors whose effects vary over time. Now, notice we're going back and forth between these two kinds of logic. Here, what we're going to be looking at is a time-invariant predictor, something that doesn't change over time. But in fact, what we're going to see is that while the predictor itself doesn't change over time, the effect of the predictor does change over time. These data were collected by Michael Foster and a host of researchers at Vanderbilt as part of a very large national randomized trial looking at the effects of alternative types of health insurance on the use of a variety of health services, including mental health services, which is what we're looking at here. What Foster did in this paper published in 2000 is he tracked the length of inpatient hospital stays among 174 teens who had been hospitalized for mental illness. Half of these kids had traditional health insurance coverage, but the other half were participating in a very innovative plan that was trying to offer better outpatient services to these families to try to decrease the length of hospital stay because they could function on the outside if they got these additional services. So here what the researchers are really asking is, does the effect of this treatment, remember this is a randomized trial, affect the risk of discharge from this mental health hospital and therefore affect the length of stay? When they fit the basic hazard model to these data, and this is actually a continuous time model, so notice that we're not modeling logit hazard anymore, we're modeling log hazard. When we fit this model to data, once again we have this partition of a baseline profile of risk and an effect of the substantive predictor here, treatment, the findings are the kinds of things you never want to have happen when you're doing a study. You've done this huge randomized trial, you've collected all the data for all these years, lo and behold, you do your statistical analysis, you look to see if the treatment has an effect, and instead of getting asterisks all over the page, what you find is that you've got a parameter, here it's 0.1457, but it is impossible to say whether that is different from zero. So the statistical test doesn't reject. Now, a lot of people would look at that and say, close up shop, there's no effective treatment, you know, there's nothing happening here. Foster went deeper, and he said, perhaps I need to fit a model that doesn't constrain the effective treatment to be the same over time. I could actually allow the effective treatment to vary over time. So he fit what we call is an interaction with time model here. And essentially the way you do it is you just literally interact the substantive predictor, here treatment, with time. So time becomes a very functioning predictor in this kind of analysis. Lo and behold, when Foster fit these models to data, what he did find is that there is an effective treatment, but the effective treatment varies over time. And you can see that both of these parameters here, now for the main effective treatment and for the interaction with time, are statistically significant. The main effective treatment is positive, the interaction with time is negative, and what you end up getting is the graph that we've got up in the upper right-hand corner of the slide. At the beginning of time, there's actually a big difference in the risk of discharge between folks who are in the comparison group and folks who are in the treatment. That's measured at the initial occasion of time by this large parameter estimate of 2.5. So there's a much greater risk of discharge at the beginning of time amongst the treated people in comparison to the control group. Over time, however, the differential between the treatment and comparison groups dissipates. And in fact, after 28 days, after a month, there's in fact no differences between the groups. The folks who are actually staying in this mental health facility for at least a month are equally likely to be discharged at any point in time after 1 month, but at the beginning of time, treatment has a huge effect. So here we have an example of a cautionary tale about not accepting just main effect findings within longitudinal research. There's no reason to expect that your predictors, whether they be time varying or time invariant, have the same exact effect over an individual's lifespan. And one of the powers of these modern methods, be they survival analysis methods, as we're illustrating here, or growth modeling methods, as we're illustrating elsewhere in the talk, you can actually begin to allow the effects of your predictors to themselves vary over time.
Now, we'd like to give you an example, another example of individual growth modeling, where we entertain the possibility that the cognitive development of children has an interesting nonlinear trajectory. And the data that we're going to use are taken from our colleague Terry Tivnan's doctoral thesis. In this thesis, as part of the thesis, Terry played the game of fox and geese with 17 first and second graders. And he played it repeatedly with each child and watched as their strategies developed during the process of playing these games. The way the game is played is that the child has four pieces on the chessboard that are the geese, and the experimenter has a single piece, which is a fox. The fox tries to get from his side of the board to the child's side of the board, and the child tries to pin the fox by moving his geese forward. The fox can move backwards and forwards. The geese can only move forward. It turns out that there's a strategy that guarantees victory in this game, but the player, the child, has to deduce that strategy. It's also possible to make for the child to make a catastrophic mistake that the experimenter can identify, and that was critical in Terry's data collection because his outcome was actually the number of moves that the child made per game prior to catastrophic mistake or victory. And the question that he asked was, what trajectories do children follow when learning the game? And here we have some data from four of the children that Terry investigated. On the vertical axis, where our outcome is the number of moves prior to catastrophic mistake made by the child. On the horizontal axis is game number. So in this case, time is not measured in seconds or minutes or years. It's just simply the number of games that were played. And you'll see it ranges from about zero up to, it's actually 27 was the maximum number of games. What's interesting is this child number six right here, for instance, never really discovered the strategy that guarantees victory. So she starts off, she gets to make one or two moves prior to catastrophic mistake. It looks as though she's starting to evolve the victory strategy about here, but then reverts back essentially to a kind of random process of playing the game. So she just kind of stutters along. Of course, every child can make at least one move prior to catastrophic mistake. The other children actually discover the strategy that guarantees victory. Some discover it earlier, like this child here, after perhaps 10 games, suddenly started to realize how the game could be won, and then pretty much for the last 10 or so games successfully beat Terry. These other two cases right here kind of fall between the two limits. Now, the question for us, we wanted to analyze these data, fit some individual growth models to these data, and ask whether the trajectories were related to the kind of intellectual development of the child in some way. The question is, what kind of individual growth model can one use to represent data that look like these? And it's clear that it would be very difficult to use the kind of individual growth model that we demonstrated earlier in this talk. I mean, for instance, a linear growth trajectory clearly is inappropriate in this case. But it turns out there are some very interesting nonlinear growth models that one can use, and we picked a particular one here. What kind did we need? Well, we needed a hypothesized individual growth model that had some kind of lower asymptote, because we knew that all children could make at least one move prior to catastrophic mistake. So we wanted the outcome variable, n moves, to have this lower asymptote, a kind of flaw to the outcome. At the same time, there are a maximum number of games, a maximum number of moves in the game, because the geese can only move forward. There are only a certain number of squares on the chessboard, and eventually there are no more moves to make for the child. So we knew that we also needed an upper asymptote. There had to be a ceiling on the number of moves. In this case, I think it's 19. We'll see in a moment. Between those two limits, we wanted a kind of smooth trajectory that joined the asymptotes. That seemed to be the most reasonable hypothesis for the nature of these trajectories. And an investigation of the literature on growth modeling suggested that a reasonable individual growth model was a logistic model. And this is a hypothesized logistic model which describes the level one relationship between the outcome, n moves, and time. And time in this case, as I said, is actually just the game number. This is a little constrained. It's set up so that it has an upper and lower asymptote that corresponds. I guess the upper asymptote is actually 20, I just realized, yeah. And in fact, you notice as time tends to infinity, this converges on 20. So this individual growth model captures our hypotheses about this change. And again, it has two interesting parameters that we can estimate and relate to background characteristics. This parameter right here, the parameter that's associated with predictor time, actually determines the rate at which the child migrates between the upper and lower between the lower and upper asymptote, and turns out to be the key parameter in this experiment. The children that have a higher value of pi 1 tend to more rapidly approach the upper asymptote. So these are the children that come to realize what the victory strategy is the most quickly. At level two, Terry also collected information on the kind of reading levels, the reading achievement of these children. The idea behind this was to try and have some single measure of their that captured their level of cognitive development, their level of intellectual development. And the question was then whether children with higher levels of intellectual development on entry into the study were more capable of learning the victory strategy. So we might anticipate, for instance, that children with higher levels of higher scores on this reading measure would tend to have higher values of pi 1. So in fact, it's this level 2 parameter, gamma 1, 1, that we're most interested in. We'd like to know whether this is statistically significant, whether it's different from zero. And if it is, it means that children with high levels of intellectual development tend to have these more dramatic dramatic individual growth trajectories. We fitted this to data. This used PROC NL-Mixed, which is a very nice routine for fitting. It's a technique for fitting multi-level models that include non-linear level one trajectories. What we're going to display here, first on that, we're going to display two prototypical plots here. So we fitted it to data, and now what we're showing you is the consequences of those data analyses. These are our conclusions. First, over on the left here, model A, we're showing you what we call an unconditional logistic growth trajectory. All this is, it's the results of an analysis in which we removed the reading predictor at level 2. So we're kind of showing you the aggregate trajectory across all children obtained from the individual growth modeling. And what you notice is, averaged over all children, there's a kind of flat S-shaped trajectory where children are basically, on average, mastering the game over, say, a 20 or 30 sets of replications. However, there's a dramatic effect when we introduce the level 2 predictor, which is this reading score, which measures the child's level of intellectual development. There's a dramatic effect of this level 2 predictor. And what you'll notice is that children of different levels of intellectual development all tend to start off in the same place, that none of these children really know how to succeed initially. They're all starting off very low. They're making catastrophic mistakes just after one or two moves into the game. But very rapidly, it's the children with the higher levels of intellectual development that rapidly come to understand what the victory strategy is and employ it. And so you see the prototypical fitted trajectory for children with these high reading scores is much more dramatic, much more successful for other children than other children. This is a nice example of what one can do with nonlinear trajectories. And in fact, one of the difficulties with using nonlinear trajectories, of course, is you have to kind of know which trajectory you want to choose. And often, hypothesis about a particular nonlinear trajectory would come from your area, your substantive area of research. It might be that a particular theory in your area of substance or prior work in your area would suggest a particular nonlinear trajectory. There's also considerable literature, particularly in some areas like biology, the investigation of human shape and size. There's a considerable literature on biometrics where individual growth trajectories are hypothesized. There's work in agriculture. There's also work in psychology. There was a lot of work done in the mid-1940s and 1950s on models for intellectual development, nonlinear models for intellectual development. A lot of the work was done here at Harvard, and it's an interesting literature to mine. What Judy and I did was we took a look at these literature, and in our book we catalog a variety of nonlinear trajectories that we think you might find useful in your own work. And on this particular slide, we illustrate, I think, four classes of nonlinear trajectory. The first class over here on the left are what we're calling hyperbolic trajectories. And these are ones essentially in what these trajectories essentially treat the time predictor. They use an inverse transformation of the time predictor over on the right-hand side here. I won't say much about the particular model. What you notice, though, is that the parameter that's associated with the time predictor, as it appears in this reciprocal, actually determines the curvature of the trajectory. So that you'll notice, as this parameter gets smaller, we move to to trajectories with a much more dramatic curvature. But all the trajectories tend towards an asymptote, and this proved to be quite a kind of interesting trajectory for many psychologists to use, because apparently in psychology lots of growth in psychology, particularly intellectual growth, tends towards an asymptote. One of the problems with this kind of model is it dives off to infinity at the lower end. So you'll notice here the curves dive down towards the horizontal axis, and there is some time at which these trajectories become head towards negative infinity. And that proves to be embarrassing in data occasionally. The second class of trajectories is simply an extension of the first class. Again, it's a hyperbolic trajectory, but what we're doing now is we're introducing additional polynomial terms for time in the denominator of the reciprocal. So in this case, not only do we have time, we have time squared, and the effect of that is to add additional curvature, and it's even possible to pull the whole trajectory over and have it come down, pull it down away from asymptote. Again, you have this problem where the trajectories dive off towards negative infinity when time gets very small, and as I said earlier, that's often embarrassing in real data, since that's not something that children can do. Then we start to move into the exponential trajectories, and the first one we illustrate is an exponential relationship between the outcome and time. E, of course, is the base of natural logarithms. And these kinds of trajectories kind of explode upwards. So you might find this kind of trajectory, say, in biology with the unmitigated growth of bacteria in growth medium, for instance, would follow this. And, you know, for many years, people hypothesized that the growth of the human population on Earth had this kind of exponential trajectory, although now it's felt that it's going to level off. These kinds of trajectories are often not much use in modeling human development, but a close relative, the negative exponential trajectories, which are essentially the exponential trajectories kind of flipped over, these trajectories are very nice, because not only do they have a property of approaching asymptote, which we saw in these early trajectories, and that proves to be appealing to psychologists, but they don't head off towards negative infinity at the lower end. They start at some reasonable positive value, and so it turns out they have a lot of competence for modeling human intellectual development. And again, there are a set of parameters in this model that determine where the intercept is, where the asymptote is, and how rapidly asymptote is approached. And so these have been very successful in modeling human cognitive development. If you're interested in this kind of thing, you should take a look at our book, and there's a more lengthy discussion there. But at the end of the day, if you decide you want to fit nonlinear growth models, you really need to think very carefully about your own substantive area, and it's that that will provide the model, not some model that we're going to suggest. And I guess, Judy, that brings us to the end of our talk, and I think you should step back into the screen now. What we'd like to do at the end here is, I think what we'd like to say is that...
this is our baby.
This is our baby.
We're very proud of it.
And anything we've said here today is said better in the book. Any mistakes we've made here today are corrected in the book. And we'd really like to suggest that you go and take a look at this. It's on reserve in the library. We've tried to write it in a way that appeals to empirical researchers, so we hope it's comprehensible. There's also an interesting development at UCLA via their academic technology services, which I'm going to ask Judy to say a few words about.
As you can tell, John and I have a little bit of missionary zeal. We're really trying to change the way empirical researchers analyze data. And one of the things we did in writing the book was say that we wanted to make the methods publicly available at no cost to as many people as possible. We don't have proprietary interest in any kind of particular software package. And so we work very closely with the folks at the UCLA Computer Center, who have developed a companion website for our book that includes all the data sets that are in the book, as well as code in all the major packages. And you can see it goes from M+, MLWIN, HLM, SAS, Data, S+, and SPSS, all the major packages. It has code for reproducing all the analyses in the book, and that is publicly available. If you just Google Applied Longitudinal Data Analysis in UCLA, you will go to the website, Feel free to download the data sets and practice with them. Feel free to download the code and try to learn how to fit the models to data. And we think it makes an excellent companion to the book, but also allows the community of researchers to learn how to actually fit these models to data. One of the things we have learned over many, many years is that it takes time to use a software package. It takes time to think about how the models that are developed in a substantive arena get translated into a statistical model and then actually get translated into computer code that you can be using to fit your model to data. Take the time to use the package that you feel most comfortable with. They all pretty much produce the same sorts of analyses. They're changing constantly, but we hope that this is a resource that you'll be able to use in practice to actually use these models in your own research.